Welcome to this episode of the Biology Trauma Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. In this episode, we're exploring the courageous journey of finding meaningful work, even creating change in broken systems, even when it means walking away from financial security and facing resistance. This topic is important to me because this has been my path, leaving conventional medicine for trying to create change and bring information directly to people. This question I got from Michael on LinkedIn. I've been in a stable job for 8 years. I make good enough money, but I want to make more of a difference. I dream of working where I can start over. And is it my trauma response keeping me stuck, or is it just common sense telling me not to rock the boat? Michael, I will answer your question at the end of this episode, but what a great question. Is this a trauma response, or is this common sense for me? My guest today is psychiatrist Dr. Eric Arzubi, who at age 30 made the life-changing decision to leave his successful career as a Wall Street trader to pursue medicine. And he is now the CEO of Frontier Psychiatry, tackling Montana's mental health crisis through innovative telehealth solutions. You'll discover why the search for meaningful work can be driven by different emotions, how safe enough provides the foundation for this kind of career change, and why you don't have to have it all figured out before you just get started. Let's dive in. What I know of Dr. Arzubi is that just before turning 30, he left his job as a Wall Street trader to pursue medicine. As you can imagine, friends and family tried to stop him, but this was a vision and a mission that he had already inside of him. Today, he is the CEO and co-founder of Frontier Psychiatry, a Montana-based telehealth company dedicated to tackling our mental health and addiction issues. And so with that, Dr. Arzubi, I have so many questions for you. First of all, what was your vision for your career path when you started medical school? Here you had been working on Wall Street. This was a big shift already. What was the vision that you had for yourself, your career, when you started medical school?
Initially, I didn't have much of a vision. I kind of went into medical school having a much better idea of what I didn't want to do, right? So I didn't want to go to a job where I didn't feel inspired to get up in the morning. I didn't want to have a job where at the end of the day, I was wondering, like, why did I spend all day doing that? I didn't want to have a job where I could imagine myself being 70 years old and going, huh, that was my one shot at life. And that's what I did. So I almost went about this by going, all right, what is it I don't want to do? And then I kind of look back at my years going to school and like, what did I really enjoy doing? And it was always, I always loved math and science, kind of like people and a role model. The idea of a role model was very important to me because I hadn't come across a role model in, you know, my first 8 years out of college and doing, you know, Wall Street and, you know, a couple other things before that. I didn't come across a role model where I said, that's the person I want to be like, except for my childhood pediatrician. Who I'd known since I was 9 months old. And he's the person I kept thinking about. So I went to medical school with a role model in mind, but I didn't quite have a vision yet.
Oh, you're taking me back to my own journey. And that there is so much similarity in that how I kind of finally landed on what I'm doing is figuring out what I didn't want to do. And that made it easier to find out, well, then what is it that I really enjoy doing the most? So for you, what was a defining moment for you in deciding to expand access to mental health and addiction care?
Yale has what's called the Yale Child Study Center, which is their child psychiatry department. And I met a few really wonderful mentors. They had like a student interest group for child psychiatry. And I don't know, somebody invited me to. I'm like, sure, I'll check it out. And I met a few really wonderful child psychiatrists who were very open, welcoming, and not looking to diagnose me with anything. So I met a group of people who, I don't know, were just passionate about helping children and families. And I thought that was kind of cool. And then at the same time, while I was finishing my pre-med work and starting medical school, I'd started tutoring kids in the community. Like, so I was living in Connecticut and I was tutoring kids in math and science, and then eventually started working with kids who had learning disabilities. And not because I said, gee, I'm an expert at that. It's because the parents were saying, hey, listen, you're good with my other kid. Can you help this one? They have a learning disability. I'm like, I know nothing about it. It doesn't matter. You get along good with my kid, so just try. I'm like, okay. So I ended up spending thousands of hours tutoring kids before med school and during medical school. And so this is where I finally found something that's my thing that I was good at. I was like, oh, I know how to talk to these kids. And the parents trust me. And when I work with these kids, something shifts in these kids, and certainly something shifts in me. I'm like, this has got to be a thing. And so when I started going to the child psychiatry interest group, everything started to kind of click, come together. And then having the idea of my role model pediatrician, I think this is the place I need to be. Now, I also carried some stigma against psychiatry. You know, I got diagnosed with anxiety right when I left Wall Street and started my pre-med stuff, because it was like, I think it was really a really gut-wrenching kind of shift going from bond trader to pre-med student in your parents' house. And I think there's just a lot of different things that contributed to that. And so when I got diagnosed with anxiety, I'm like, oh, I don't need to see anyone. Then, you know, that lasted about a week. I'm like, all right, I got to see someone. And then I saw a psychiatrist and I said, listen, I just want to talk. I don't need meds. And that lasted another week. And I'm like, all right, I need meds. But I had my own kind of bias or stigma against like needing this help. And when I was in medical school, I also felt, I'm like, you know what? Psychiatry's cute, but maybe I'll do neurology because that's real medicine. Psychiatry is not real medicine. And, you know, so I kind of lived with that for a while. And then I said to myself, you know, what do I really want to do on a day-to-day basis? And it was spending this time with the kids and the families and knowing that I could actually shift things if I was able to do that effectively. And that's how I landed on child psychiatry. So anyway, that wasn't the question you asked, but I wanted to help give you a kind of idea how I got from this one place to eventually deciding that this maybe was the path for me.
Your story sounds so familiar to those people who end up being very heart-centered in their practice, where there is a lot of soul searching that's involved in that process of finally landing on what you enjoy doing, what is your strengths, what's your heart saying, and that combination. It's not linear like your experience shows. It goes through a process of really digging deep to find out, who am I? What do I really want? Is that okay to really want this and to create this kind of career path that will not necessarily be easy, but it's where my passion is at.
You're right. It's like you said, it's the thing you mentioned there is kind of giving yourself permission and grace to do things that maybe were or are kind of unexpected for maybe for yourself, but also what other people might have expected, right? Because when I made the shift, you know, people were like, wait, what are you doing? Why? And it didn't make a lot of sense to people. But what didn't make sense to me was to keep doing what I was doing. That made no sense to me.
That's a really good point. And as I reflect back on my own journey, as you're sharing yours, again, there's so many similarities. And I had an experience where I had started a nonprofit helping other adoptive families parent their children who are having attachment and trust issues. And when I went through my crisis of, I can't keep doing what I am doing, I can't be part of this, what would I do? It was that ability to have that experience that you're describing that you had with the kids and the families of, this is what's really meaningful to me. Because if I hadn't have had that, I wouldn't have been able to use that as a resource, to use that as a guiding light towards, so then this is what I want to create, even though it's unconventional, even though it's unexpected, even though it's not what other people might do, being able to have those experiences in our lifetime that have been so meaningful that they change our life.
Right. I mean, who would have thought, again, looking back, and as you're saying this, you're so right. Who the heck would have thought that tutoring biology to, you know, a ninth grader would have been life-changing for me? I mean, clearly it was. I think it's a fantastic point.
Clearly it was, but you let it change your life. And I think a lot of people are afraid to let those experiences change their life because it would be doing something different. And you had the courage to allow that to change your life and inspire something that would be different and unconventional.
I think there's some courage to it, I believe. There's also a really deep-seated fear and anxiety, right? Because I'd love to tell you, well, like, it was courage. I mean, I am so brave. I just take risks because I'm amazing. No, that's not what happened, right? I was terrified of spending years doing something that was going to make me unhappy. So it was like that fear was really more the driver rather than looking in the mirror going, Eric, you're going to be a doctor. And you know what? Forget what everybody else says because you're the man. Like, no, I was scared. I was scared of feeling this way every day. And I was scared of not doing something that gave me energy, right? So I'm sure there are two sides of it. I'm sure there was some courage involved. In fact, it actually took me two attempts to leave Wall Street. 1998, I told my bosses, I said, look, I'm going to go do pre-med and then because I had to go do pre-med first because I had not done pre-med. So I had to do a couple of years of pre-med classes before actually applying to medical school. And so I was 28, told my bosses at Morgan Stanley, I said, hey, thanks. It's been a great ride. Appreciate it. I'm going to go do pre-med work. They're like, all right, you're weird, but good luck. So I'd gotten into this, the pre-med program at Yale. And so I was driving to physics class. It was a January of that year. I go sit in the class and I'm looking around all these young kids and like, huh, my colleagues are over on, you know, on the trading floor right now and in Times Square. Huh. I leave class, I get in the car and I have a panic attack. I'm like, what the hell did I just do? Oh my God. I was making really good money for anyone. I mean, here I was 28 years old and I just said, no, thanks. I'm going to physics class. And I was terrified. And I called my bosses in New York City. I go, listen, I was kidding. Can I come back? They're like, sure, come back. So I came back to work and I said, you know what? I'm just going to be a rich bond trader. Like, forget this. That was scary. Thank God I didn't do that. And I was miserable for that year. I was miserable. I was regretting that I didn't try it. I hated again going to work in the morning. And that year too, I was going to my bosses saying, listen, just pay me less, but give me something more interesting to do because this buying and selling stuff doesn't make sense. And they're like, what do you mean pay you less? Like, what are you doing on Wall Street? And, you know, I was just trying, I was searching. And so I signed up for a program in New York City to do pre-med. I went back to my bosses and like, I think I want to try it again. And this amazing managing director, and he didn't have to do this, but he said to me, he said, Eric, look, why don't you just figure out what you want to do? I'm going to give you 9 months. Go do your thing. In 9 months, you decide. If you want to come back, you can come back. If not, just stay in school. And really, that's what let me really kind of gave me the safety to give that a try. And I'll always be grateful to him. And he opened that door for me and I walked through it.
And you used a key word that I'm grabbing onto because here in the biology of trauma, we incorporate polyvagal theory quite a bit. And this idea that all positive change, all healing is based on safety. So to hear that he gave you the safety to experiment, to go try it out and be able to come back, but he gave you safety. That is huge. And I'm so glad that you had that experience. And I would want other people to think through of what would I need to feel safe enough? What would I need to feel safe enough to explore what I really want to do in life and not be stuck at a job that I really don't enjoy?
I also think as a father, I have two daughters. They're twin 18-year-olds. I often thought about my own experience and really trying to do everything I can to make them feel safe to experiment, to roam, to wonder, to be curious. I hope I'm giving my daughters the safety to explore without feeling that, oh, dad's going to not like it if I study this or try that.
You know, there are tens and hundreds of thousands of people who consider changing their career because they find themselves just like you were, unhappy, unsatisfied, and yet feel trapped because of that very thing that you're speaking to is the messaging that we grew up with. And for different people, the details may be different, but it's so often the same story where I was told that I couldn't explore, I couldn't do what I wanted to do because I needed to make sure that I was able to make a good living, that I was providing, creating security for myself and would be creating security for my family. So this idea of just creating the safety for our next generation to say, no, like you can have both. You can find a job, create a job, create work that you both really enjoy and can bring you the finances that you need to be comfortable enough in life.
That's exactly right. And what is the definition of success? Like when we go off to school, like what are we chasing? Right? What are we chasing? I mean, is it success? I mean, and if so, what is the definition of success? You know, one of the things I kind of landed on for myself, and actually think about this for my patients too, when people are like, oh, what do you want for your patients? You want them to be happy? I'm like, no. What I want for my patients is peace of mind. That's what I want for my daughters. That's what I'd like for myself. Because if you have peace of mind, everything else hopefully will unfold. Right? Because otherwise, without the peace of mind, you're just kind of, you have this, like you were mentioning before, it's like the way you're brought up generates, right? It's kind of this blueprint for how you see the world, which then generates this self-talk, right? And in the end, I feel strongly that the self-talk that we have is really the source of a lot of our problems, but also a lot of our success, right? And so hopefully, and because I was kind of aware of this when I was raising my girls, and I still am, and I screw up all the time. But my hope is that the conversation I've had with them, I know is going to be hardwired into how they see the world. And so my hope is that I've given them self-talk that hopefully is not hurtful or limiting.
Our inner state directs so much of our life. And when we don't have that peace of mind, when we don't have that internal state of peace, we are in survival mode, and that will drive a lot of our decisions, but also, like you say, make us chase things that won't actually bring us the peace, the safety, the security, the connection that we are really craving inside. So that inner state, I know that along your path, you have had to create and have an inner state of surmounting obstacles and challenges, because I know with what you have done, there had to have been several challenges that you've encountered in expanding access to mental health and addictions there in Montana. What have been some of those challenges, and how have you faced them, given your history and your experiences?
So yes, there were a ton of challenges, right? So 2013, I left Connecticut, came to Montana. How did that happen? Well, I was looking for a job actually in Connecticut. I thought I was going to end up working as a psychiatrist. And I saw this email where they're looking for a psychiatrist in Montana. And my wife and I were talking. It's like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we lived in a place that's beautiful, I consider retiring to, and the girls could do outdoor stuff. And also, I think I was also pretty burned out on this chasing this idea of building a great resume. Because I felt like for a long time, what I was doing was building a great resume. And I didn't want that for my daughters. I'm like, yeah, because I felt, oh, I got to go to Yale. And I went to Georgetown because I need these brands. Once I have these brands on my resume, it means I'm okay. Very quickly, having a really cool resume doesn't make all the kind of the anxiety and insecurities go away. So it's not like I sit at home every day and look at my resume and go, look how great I am. And that brings me peace of mind. That doesn't happen. So I'm like, all right, if that doesn't happen for me, it's not going to happen for my girl. So I want my girls to have a different feeling of what kind of success is and not have to be a part of this rat race in the Northeast, right? So anyway, we come to Montana in 2013, and I had no idea when I moved to Montana that Montana ranked among the worst three states in terms of suicide rates. Montana was one of three states with no psychiatry training program. It was pretty stark. I just didn't know. Like, I came to Montana, I'm like, oh, it's beautiful. How nice. I look at the mountains, but Montana, like Wyoming and Alaska, those are the other two states that have the highest suicide rates, right? They have a pretty spread out population. People, when I arrived in Montana, people were driving 4 hours to see me for a half hour visit. And so moms had to leave work, miss a day of work, kids had to miss a day of school, spend all this money on gas, and sometimes had to spend the night like in Billings, Montana, just for the half hour visit. That made no sense to me. You know, Montana also has some vulnerable populations in terms of some social determinants of health that are particularly difficult. So, for example, Montana ranks in the top five when it comes to military veteran population per capita, right? Lots of folks with PTSD who have been deployed and so forth. Montana also has a high number of Native Americans, including seven Indian reservations and 11 Native American tribes, with lots of historical trauma and difficulty accessing or trusting care. And so this is all contributing to kind of the difficulty that Montana faces, you know. And then I start my career as a psychiatrist at age 44. It was in 2013. I'm like, all right, I have less time to make a difference. So I got work to do. Right. So of course here I am like putting more pressure on myself. Right. So I got to go solve this problem. So about a year after I got there, I became chair of psychiatry at the Billings Clinic, which is the biggest health system here. And I was leading, I think we had like 20 psychiatrists at the time. We had an inpatient unit, an outpatient clinic and emergency room care that we were providing. And I think one of the things I uncovered that I'm good at is looking at our continuum of care and going, oh, that's obviously a problem that we need to fix. So for example, and I was in front of our CEO and kind of the leadership at the hospital, and I was telling them, look, I'm having difficulty trying to attract child psychiatrists or psychiatrists in general to move to Montana to deliver care. And the CEO, wonderful guy at the time, said to me, well, why don't you start the psychiatry residency program? I'm like, oh, okay. So I did. And so, you know, I mean, it helped to have his blessing and him kind of, as a leader, kind of make that known that we're going to commit to this. But I had to go and find the money. I had to go talk to the legislature to try to get the funding. Half of the psychiatrists in the department didn't want this to happen because it was more work for them. And I really struggled with working with psychiatrists who couldn't put the patients first and solving the patient problems first. I found I really struggled with psychiatrists who were kind of psychiatrist-centered. And that was a big challenge. And the other thing is, I was only a year out of training, and I was their boss all of a sudden. They're like, you know, so they didn't love that. Then they didn't love that I was going to kind of, you know, shift the ground from under them and say, we're going to build a psychiatry residency program. So that, a lot of the old timers were pretty unhappy with me. So really, that was hard, because it was easier to build a psychiatry training program than it was to kind of, you know, kind of really push against some of the resistance I was getting from my own psychiatrists. And also being part of a big healthcare system, there's lots of things you can and can't do. And, you know, I had very strong feelings about who I needed on my team and who didn't need to be on my team, but the health system didn't necessarily allow me to make the changes I needed to do. So that was hard. And so that was challenging, but eventually we got it taken care of, got it done, and started a training program that trained psychiatrists here in Montana. Similarly, we opened a psychiatry emergency program, what's called an empath unit. It's getting more traction nowadays. An empath unit, empath stands for Emergency Psychiatric Assessment, Treatment, and Healing Unit. And it's a model that was started, I don't know, like 20 years ago by a guy named Dr. Scott Zeller, wonderful, wonderful psychiatrist. And he started the first one in Alameda, California. And so, you know, around 2016-17, the Billings Clinic where I was working, they had some money set aside that they were going to use to make some improvements in the emergency room. And at the time, we were getting 15 to 20 patients in crisis coming to our emergency room every day from northern Wyoming, all of Montana, and the western side of the Dakotas. Now, just to give you a little context, this, and I still, it's hard for me to believe sometimes, I have to always double check, and I'm like, I still can't believe it. Do you know how many Connecticuts you can fit in Montana? 27. You can fit 27 Connecticuts in Montana. And Connecticut has 3.5 million people. Montana has 1 million people. Or here's another one. If I drive from, let's say Chicago is right here and DC is here, that distance is the same distance as it is from one corner to the opposite corner of Montana. So Montana is enormous, right? So people were coming from all over Montana, northern Wyoming, and the western Dakotas to our emergency room because there was no other place to go, because we were kind of it for psychiatry in that region. And so 15 to 20 people a day. And sometimes patients were waiting 10, 12 hours to see one of our psychiatrists. And I had a hard time letting that be the norm. And so I looked around for other models to improve the quality of care and came across the empath unit. And again, you know, leadership was supportive. The CEO was like, all right, Eric, do it. So I started putting it together, trying to figure out ways to get more funding, worked with some great people. Again, my own psychiatrist pushing back, going, this is crazy. It's never going to work. Because basically what it is, it's like one big living room with some recliners where people can come in and immediately get access to psychiatric care. But it meant a change in doing the way you were doing things before. People thought it was going to be more work, on and on and on and on, right? All these reasons why it can't be done, it can't be done, it can't be done. And I mean, it even got to the point where half of the psychiatry team actually organized a meeting with the leadership and said, we don't want Eric to do this whole new program. So again, I had to kind of fight through that resistance to change. When we opened the empath unit, nobody wanted to staff it. So I did. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it then. And so pretty much the first year was kind of me in this unit because I fully believed in it. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to show people this works. This to me is, this is a no-brainer. And sure enough, probably within a month, the wait times for patients to be seen went from 10 hours on average to less than 4 hours. Our need to hospitalize people went way down. Our need to rehospitalize people went down. And as soon as people started to see that, you know, the world didn't end, people became more open to like, oh, okay, maybe I'll give it a try. And there were still a bunch of naysayers, but people eventually came around. The patients loved it. The emergency room, it was a much more collaborative environment. It wasn't like psychiatrists saying to the ER, you know, you guys are doing a bad job. And the ER saying to the guy, psychiatrist, you're doing a bad job. Those are just some examples of, you know, some of the challenges that we had to overcome. And I guess one of the things I've learned is that people talk about stigma and the system and this and that, the other thing. And that's I think, often a really easy way to not look in the mirror. We in psychiatry own a lot of the problem. I'm not saying we own all of it, but we in psychiatry own a lot of the problem because we talk about this mental health crisis that has actually happened under our watch. Like, so what are we doing to do things completely different and outside the box? We need to be able to look at this problem from a completely fresh set of eyes.
I think that what sets people apart, what makes one practitioner do something very different and do something big in the world that's going to make an impact versus the other practitioners who go along and maybe participate in the complaining, but don't actually make change happen. And I think it comes down to that question that you asked yourself, which for me, I see it as not just responsibility, not just feeling responsible to be part of the solution, but actually needing to take a radical level of personal responsibility. Because as you've experienced and as I've experienced, the system will be against us. The system will resist change. People will resist change. That's human nature. And so it's nothing bad on the system or the people. That's just what will happen is when we try to create change, there will be resistance. And unless I am committed to being part of the solution, unless I've committed to having a radical level of personal responsibility where I am asking, but what could I do about this? I read a headline and I remember the same thoughts going through my mind as what went through yours. Okay, I'm reading a headline on the role of trauma in chronic disease, the role of trauma in addictions. What could I do about it? Rather than just let it be a headline that, as you say, will just continue to be a headline until people step up to be part of the change, to be part of the solution. And saying that, the resistance really is what can drain a person. It can be what stops them. It can be what discourages them so much that they're not able to finish what they started and finish the vision that they had to be able to push through that. So we're really talking about building something and how do we build something in the midst of that resistance? This is what I experienced as well. And so as I'm listening to your story, it's still taking me down memory lane where I'm in general surgery and I'm getting burnt out. I'm realizing this is not where I'm really happy. And so I'm doing my soul searching and I decide to do something like you, unexpected, unconventional, and be like, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to become an attachment, trauma, and addiction specialist. And they're like, that's not a field of medicine. And I'm like, watch me. I'm going to make it.
It is now.
It is now. But the resistance that I got, even in, like you say, even in the fields where it should have been embraced with open arms, I started with preventive medicine. That's the field where the adverse childhood experiences study was started. And they're still resistant. So then I moved to addiction medicine because surely they will have open arms and embracing trauma and actually applying trauma recovery to addictions. The resistance was huge. And again, most of it centered around money and what health insurance was willing to pay for. But then I'm just left with, well, do I stay in this system or do I find a way to be part of the solution, which for me meant leaving the system and learning how to build something outside of the system so that I could take information directly to individuals and other practitioners who would want to learn this. But for you, like you built something as well. You built in spite of, or maybe because of the resistance. And if you had to start over, Dr. Arzubi, if you had to start over knowing everything you know now, what would you do differently in building Frontier Psychiatry?
I can easily give you a list of kind of things that I've learned over time, but I don't know that I would have learned them if I hadn't done things the way I did them. Like, you know, I kind of had to build a healthcare organization from scratch. I guess I would have known everything I needed to know, you know, because I didn't know what I didn't know. And, you know, I'm like, oh, I guess you just bill insurance companies. And, you know, that's so complicated. And then, you know, they just flip on a camera and it's good to go. Well, no, not everybody has access to broadband. And so, you know, so there's so many things I just learned along the way. I am super grateful, actually, for the resistance I faced during my time at Billings Clinic, because I also realized I had a lot of learning to do as a leader. I thought, if I have an amazing idea, everybody's going to know it's amazing and just follow me, clearly. Well, it doesn't work that way, it turns out. It turns out I was really bad at change management. I was really bad at communicating the why on a consistent basis of what we were doing. I just assumed people would fill in the blanks and know it's a great idea and we're going to help people. No, right? People tend to fill in any information gaps with their own stuff and their own explanations that that aren't always give you grace or are generous, right? So, again, I think I wish I would have known a lot of kind of the details, the nuts and bolts, the blocking, tackling stuff better. But the evolution of kind of how I got to this point, I think it just happened the way it's supposed to happen. And I learned the skills that, you know, the way you always learn important lessons the hard way. And I guess I wish I would have been sort of a better leader to begin with, when I was implementing these new programs. I wish I would have done a better job communicating it to the rest of the team, because maybe I wouldn't have faced as much resistance. Maybe I could have done a better job communicating the why, the purpose, and maybe that would have been more helpful and kind of greased the wheels a little bit more. So, you know, I like to sit there and say, well, it's all their fault. They don't understand how brilliant I am. Well, no, I could have done a much better job communicating the why and the purpose. That would have probably been helpful. Yeah, I think I'm just doing things the way it's supposed to, the way it's supposed to happen. I just wish I would have known more of the details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for those here and listening, he just dropped some gold nuggets. First of all is, don't wait until it's perfect to start, because it will never be perfect. You will never know everything before you get started. It's when you get started that you're like, oh, I don't know how to do that. Oh, I didn't even consider that being a problem. Don't wait until it's perfect to start to build it. Second of all, the process of building it is how we grow personally as well. This is how we find our own growth edges. This is how we find out, oh, I guess I'm not as great at communicating like I thought I was. Oh, I guess I'm not as good of a leader as I thought I was. The building is our own personal development school. It's where we will find the next layers for us to heal different aspects of ourselves and create change in ourselves that we would never even see if we hadn't decided to build something big, make a difference, and be part of the change. So with that, Eric, thank you. Thank you for your time, but so much more than that, right? Like, thank you for being the kind of person who is willing to build, who's willing to be part of the solution, who's willing to face the resistance and all that that means for becoming a better person, becoming a better practitioner, and always keeping the patient first. Now, to get back to Michael's question, what you're experiencing, Michael, is actually quite common. I see this all the time in the practitioners who come into the biology trauma training. They're trying to make a career change, and it is very hard. And there is this aspect of, I don't know if I'm going to make enough money to be able to make this change. This episode is a reminder that sometimes what feels like anxiety about change might actually be our body's wisdom guiding us towards a greater alignment in our life. Change is a stress, though, on the body, and we can push our body over the edge. Sometimes what we label as common sense to stay put is actually our adaptive survival response to avoiding the discomfort of change, the discomfort of uncertainty. And so how to recognize if this is our own trauma response showing up, that is when we notice that we are staying small to stay safe. Our nervous system is wired to resist change when change has not been safe. It's wired to keep us safe. And when uncertainty and those things that have not been familiar have been sources of trauma for us in the past, our body will shut down in order to protect us from taking positive change in our life. What's interesting is how Dr. Arzubi described his own decision, not necessarily as an act of courage, but actually as a response to fear of spending decades in a life and work that drained him rather than fulfilled him. And that fear of regret ultimately became the stronger motivator for him than the fear of change. Now, that may be different for you, Michael, but the question is, can you map out a first step that doesn't feel like too big of a change? 1 hour a weekend or one evening a week and start learning, preparing, putting together a plan, saving money for this transition. Too much too fast is what overwhelms us and paralyzes us, causing a freeze response as we contemplate a career change. And so the key insight from today's episode is the importance of creating safety for the changes that we want to make in our life and our career. What small step can I do today to create safety for this change that I want to make in my life or my work? Remember, knowing the impact of overwhelm on our biology, it causes a biology of trauma. We don't do overwhelm anymore. So even for those areas that we want to create positive change, we don't do it in a way that overwhelms us. We still create the safe enough feeling. Michael, I've got some resources and guides for you in the show notes about this. First of all is my biology of trauma book, How the Body Experiences and Holds Fear, Pain, and Overwhelm, and How to Repair It. I encourage you to read this book. The pre-order is now available. And when you pre-order, you will also get into the insider circle. Well, I am doing live readings until the publication date. You'll also want to understand the essential sequence. So I'll put a link to that guide in the show notes. This is the essential sequence to how to safely create that positive change, how to create safety around opening up these adaptive survival responses. How we do that is what makes the difference, because we're either creating overwhelm or a sense of safety as we do it. That safety is done through the essential sequence. And it sounds like we might be dealing with some chronic freeze response here. So I'll throw in that guide as well. A link for the guide for the chronic freeze response in the show notes. Learn what to do and what not to do when your body gets stuck in that freeze response, staying small to stay safe. A few related podcast episodes. Episode 20 is on the connection between money, loneliness, and trauma. And episode 116 was with Bessel van der Kolk, author of The Body Keeps the Score. Now, why I included this one was because he spoke to the resistance to things that he wanted to implement in that episode. And if you're contemplating the career change, you will likely also encounter some resistance. There is a YouTube video that you might find helpful, Understanding the Nervous System, Transforming Trauma, and People Pleasing, because that might be an aspect that makes it hard for you to change your career. With that, I'm here to save you time and money by bringing you practical information that will help you accelerate the trauma healing journey. So please take a moment to leave a review. This is what helps me know how to improve the podcast, bring you great content, and help others find the information that can change their lives as well. I'm your host, Dr. Amy. Until next episode, lots of love.